Welcome to Book Talk. I'm Alan Farley, and this week it's all about the latest novel by an esteemed Booker Prize winner. Stay tuned. Joining me now is Alan Hollinghurst, here with his latest novel, The Stranger's Child. Welcome back to KALW.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Well, I know the last time you were here, we talked about The Line of Beauty, which is your novel that won the Man Booker Prize. And I don't know if we talked about that at the time, but do you ever feel like you're in competition when you're writing something?
I never do at all, I must say, no. I suspect some writers do have a more competitive streak than I do, but actually, no, it's very far from my thoughts. I very much go into my own space and my own world when I'm writing. And my main objective really is to sort of satisfy myself. So I don't really think about... I don't really even think about the reader beyond hoping that they'll like it, you know. And I certainly don't think about what other writers may be doing.
Well, I have to tell you, I've just fell in love with this novel, and right away in the first section, I mean, it's there are five parts to it. In the first part, it just seemed to me like you really loved that era. It was so meticulous and so, but it just seemed it just took you right to that first part of the last century, and I believed every bit of it.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear you say that. Yes, I mean, I felt that first section, which is set in September 1913, was, in a way, the hardest to write, because our own sense of what happened in that period just before the Great World War comes primarily from reading novels set in that period and probably seeing film adaptations of them and so forth. And there's something kind of irreducibly literary about our sense of such eras in the past. E.M. Forster seemed to be hovering in the shadows there, and I had to rather get him. I didn't want to write pastiche Forster, and it was very much my aim in each of the five sections of the book, which are spread over nearly a century, to plunge the reader each time into a sense of that this was the present for the characters. You know, there's no framing narrative. They're all living, as we all do, with no knowledge of what's going to happen to them. But I'm very pleased you felt the period thing came off. I think myself the secret is probably not to overdo it with the period details and the period signifiers, you know, because as we all know, our present lives are an extraordinary mixture of things out of the past. Nobody lives in a kind of pure period, like you sometimes see in movies set in the 1920s or 30s, where everything is happening in a sort of sleek Art Deco world or something, with no intrusions from all the accumulated history which lies all around. So I think a light touch is probably the answer.
Well, and it has to do with a poet, Cecil Vance, and a poem that he wrote almost on the spur of the moment. He's visiting with friends and is asked to write in an autograph book and decides to write a poem and call it 2 Acres, which is the name of the estate where he's visiting. And that poem, and then he's killed in the war at 25?
Yes.
Something like that. And each section of the book sort of follows the life of his afterlife and the life of that poem through the succeeding, as you say, almost a century. And it's just a fascinating idea.
Well, I'm glad you think so, yes. I had early on the idea that I wanted to write a book about the Great War, but not actually to have the Great War in it. And I think, you know, that's not the sort of novelist I am, really. I mean, I've always been interested in writing about sort of human interrelations in a more sort of intimate and domestic level. So my idea was that you would meet a group of characters just before the war and then join those of them who survived some years after the war and see what had happened to them in the interim and what damage had been done, how they'd sort of reconstructed their lives after this immense traumatic event. Then when I saw that one of them was going to be a poet who was killed in the war, it seemed to me there was the makings of something much longer, which would trace various things. I suppose changes in taste, changes in literary reputation, and also changes in biography. I think it's, I thought of it very much as a book about the sort of changing standards of what can be said about the private life of people in biography.
Mm-hmm. Right, there is perhaps a gay aspect to his career, his life, and which is something that is suppressed, of course, at the time. And later on, his biographer, Paul Bryant, was trying to get at that, to talk to people who knew him. And I really sympathize with Paul in that I've had not exactly the similar experience, but I've, for like 20-plus years, I've been working and interviewing people who knew Noel Coward, not to write a biography, but just to you know, to do a radio program about him. And I haven't had the kinds of things, but I've dealt with people who are, you know, in their 80s and 90s, sort of the same kind of problems that Paul had talking to Daphne.
Yeah.
Although there was nothing I was trying to dig out that wasn't known, but it's there's such verisimilitude in that chapter, in every one of them, actually.
Well, good. Yes, I mean, I was fascinated by the whole question of memory, really. And I think it's probably a book I wouldn't have written even 10 years ago, but I'm so struck as I move through my 50s by how fallible my own memory is, and struck by the way that I and somebody else who were both present at an event can remember it in quite different ways. And so by the very sort of untrustworthy nature of memory itself as a means of sort of reconstructing the past, you know. I think myself it's very hard to remember accurately more than a few words that someone said to me last week, you know, much less 50 years ago. So I thought it would be amusing to have this initial, the first part of the book in 1913 just occupies one weekend when various things happen and this poem gets written, possibly, ostensibly, sort of dedicated to a young girl, but possibly really written about her brother. Yes, the later sections of the book sort of go back over this territory, trying to tease things out of it, or, indeed, in some cases, cover things up in it. I think, you know, it begins in the sort of long aftershadow of the Victorian era, when nothing could be said publicly about the private life. In the 1920s, when someone's trying to write a memoir of Cecil, it's clear that his domineering mother is going to prevent anything unpleasant seeping out. And it's really only after the 1960s, I think, that you get a big change and it becomes possible to say new things. I mean, in England, because of the Sexual Offences Act of 1967, which decriminalised homosexuality and sort of led, by degrees, into a whole new era in which people could, for the first time, really, write openly about the private lives of gay writers or, I mean, other subjects of biography.
You mentioned the bill and Leo Abbs, who I guess was the Welsh a member of Parliament who proposed that
exactly
bill,
yes.
that decriminalised homosexuality.
Yeah, that's just on the third section of the book, set in 1967, is just on the eve of that bill being passed.
I've looked him up just because I thought, now is this a real character? And in turn, he was also an anti-abortionist, which I found a little.
I didn't know that. Yes, yeah. That's interesting.
Well, at least that's what Wikipedia says.
Oh, well, it must be right.
But, also in the, I forget which section now, where I guess in parties are going on, I guess it's the rebel section.
Yes.
There's a reference to the game of adverbs.
Yes.
And winsomely is mentioned. Of course, it took me right back to hay fever.
Yes, exactly. No, that was a conscious allusion to the use of that game in Noel Coward. Yes, I've always wanted to sort of have a game of adverbs. Well, I almost had one in The Line of Beauty, and I almost had one in the... one day I will.
Yes, it'd be. I've never actually attempted to play a game of adverbs, but it would be fun.
Yes. I can't quite exactly remember how it works, but you people choose an act, and somebody else, one person chooses the manner in which the act is to be performed, and then the other people have to guess what the adverb is.
Right. And I know Noel Coward was the name came up one other time when someone, I think, was described as saying something in a Noel Coward voice.
Exactly, yes.
in that period, I guess that same period, 20s, 30s part of the book. Well, and the before the biography, before Paul is writing his biography, there is a book, I guess, about the poems, a book of his poems and letters.
Yes, there's the poems are published in the late 1920s, though we sort of learn much later on that they may have been tidied up and enhanced and one way or another by their editor. And the poems become very well known. It's clear that Cecil Vallance wasn't a very good poet, but he's one of those sort of second-rate poets who nonetheless sort of work their way into common consciousness, perhaps more than, you know, greater ones. He obviously owes a certain amount to the figure of Rupert Brooke, and I was interested in Brooke's story and how Brooke himself was turned into this sort of icon, of emblem of the gilded youth that had been destroyed by the First World War after his own early death. The poem which Cecil writes at the end of the first section of the book, the poem to Acres, owes something to Rupert Brooke's famous poem, Grantchester. Both poems written before the war, but which after the war seem to sum up the sort of idyll of English life that's been that's been lost. For a while I thought I was going to have to write the whole of this long poem, but then I realised the point of the poem really was that it was something which people knew of, they knew phrases from it, they could quote a couplet from it, perhaps. And so I felt, in the end, I probably only wrote about 15 lines of it, and it's something which is alluded to more than seen.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. How much of Cecil's poetry did you actually have to write?
I wrote no more than what you actually see on the page in the novel.
And we're talking with Alan Hollinghurst about The Stranger's Child, his latest novel, and again, one of the central figures is the poet Cecil Vallance, and his poem, Two Acres. And where is it? Someone was referring to saying, oh, well, it's only 2 acres, whereas the estate where he grew up was how many acres?
3,000.
3,000 acres.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, to the Saults who he's visiting, two acres seems a very generous spread, but when right. he lets it slip that actually he has 3,000 acres, they realize they're not quite so grand after all.
And then 2 acres is described, I guess, as sort of Victorian monstrosity in terms of the estate itself, or the home.
Crawley Court, the Vallance's home, is
right.
of the house of a kind which came to be called a Victorian.
Oh, that's right. 2 acres is not... No. That's
2 acres
place.
Is a more sort of idyllic arts and crafts
right.
House with obviously a large and lovely garden. I mean, a relatively modest house, I think, but with a lot of garden. Crawley Court is one of those very challenging red brick Victorian Gothic buildings put up by some sort of new money in the 1880s or so. And then after the Great War, when, I mean, the generation in the 1920s turned so vehemently against all things Victorian, and Cecil's brother, who inherits the house, sort of detests it and is trying to disguise all its ornate Victorian features by boxing them in and putting in sort of hygienic white modern interior. Then in the 1960s, when Victorian architecture was really coming under threat in England, it was rediscovered and championed, you get someone sort of rediscovering these hidden beauties of the house. So I hope the house acted as a sort of gauge of changes in taste,
but
as well as society.
You know. It became a boarding school.
It becomes a boarding school. I mean, so many houses of that kind did. They were taken over by one or other branch of the military in the war, and then after the war, the owners often found in that, you know, very difficult period that they simply couldn't afford to keep up these houses, and so a huge number were demolished, and a huge number were turned to institutional uses of one kind or another. And having been to a boarding school in a large Victorian Gothic country house myself, I felt I had the whole subject at my fingertips.
Well, now Cecil's brother Dudley is also a writer, his surviving brother who lived long after, and I guess he writes a memoir, which is doesn't really tell anything.
No, I mean, we don't see a lot of it, and it clearly, like him, has a rather sort of sarcastic slant on things which he might have been expected to treat more tenderly. There's a great sense of rivalry between him and his brother. In the second section of the book, in 1926, where the survivors have gathered to offer their memories of Cecil to the biographer, Dudley is clearly very put out by all this and does various things to disrupt the whole party and take it over and introduce other people who could. I think he was much less favoured by his parents than Cecil was, and he was always the rebellious and difficult one. And to this is added some sort of traumatic war experience, where he's clearly been both physically and sort of emotionally damaged by the war, and become a very tricky customer altogether, I think.
Well, and the biographer, Paul, runs into, meets him at a party, but and finally can't bring himself to try to question him.
That's right, yes. Yeah, so that's a long scene at a conference about the writing of the Great War in Oxford, where I've introduced various people, I mean real people, alongside these fictional ones. Yes, I mean he's a very disdainful old aristocratic man who's still troubled, I think, by the fact that people are interested in his long dead brother, and they ought to be being interested in him.
Right. And then, of course, there's his ex-wife,
Daphne,
who's really, I guess, the one character who's almost, up until the fourth section anyway, is there, and that's the person that Paul wants to finally get to, and the biographer, and spends a couple of days with her, although she has thoughts that she shouldn't have seen him, but
yes.
and living now nearly blind and with her son.
That's right, yes. So Daphne is a sort of the main thread, I suppose, through the book. There's nobody in the final 2008 section left alive who was alive at the beginning, but there are two survivors of the three survivors, actually, of the first section, because there's also Jonah, who was the servant at the house,
oh,
15-year-old
right, yes.
Servant in 1913, whom the assiduous biographer tracks down as a man in his 80s and tries to get something out of him about what he might have seen on this weekend in 1913, of which he seems to be able to remember nothing at all. But Daphne, I thought of as, yes, as a sort of thread through these different epochs. She's someone who in the first two sections of the book we're very sort of inward with. Then in the third section, one of the little shocks and sort of disconcertments that I hope I throw at the reader is that we see her as someone about to be 70, but very much from the outside, and I think the reader won't realise at first that this is the same person, and she's been twice married since, and she's changed her name, and I wanted to recreate that sense that I've certainly often had of getting to know people who are a lot older than me, and the slow and very piecemeal way that one puts together a sense of what their pasts was. A biographer in his 30s, speaking to a subject in their 80s, has got a more exaggerated sort of version of the task that we all do in trying to sort of sort out each other's lives and piece things together. But they're brought, the young biographer and Daphne are brought together at the end of the fourth section for this sort of two-day interview. And I hope that the reader, who's been encouraged to be on Paul's side and Daphne's side previously, doesn't quite know where their sympathies lie in this scene. And actually, neither of them really behaves very well.
Well, and I almost didn't recognize Paul in the next section, because he's a lot older. And I thought, oh, I didn't realize how much time had passed.
That's right. In the final section, yes, he's in his mid-60s. And again, being seen from the outside himself by somebody else. So I wanted to get that sense, yes, of people sort of passing each other, as it were, in the stream of history, and not necessarily being involved with each other. Just that sense that we're all minor characters in other people's lives. You know, we're only the major character in our own life, really.
We're talking with Alan Hollinghurst about The Stranger's Child, his latest novel, which spans nearly a century, from 1913 to 2008. And well, what was the inspiration? Was it Rupert Brooke or the war? You mentioned that you wanted to write about the Great War,
yes,
but about the war.
I had that idea initially, and an idea about the effects of war in general, I think. You know, I mean, it's so present to us now with seeing coffins flown home from Afghanistan every week, you know, on the television. And so something, again, I knew I didn't want to write a war novel, but I would write a book in which, in the gaps between the episodes, wars had happened. And the Second War also sort of makes its mark on the narrative. And that was one of the things. The other, I think, just was exploring these questions of literary reputation and the sort of changing ethos about, you know, our understanding of the private life, really. I mean, somebody who read a biography in 1913 would not expect to learn anything about the sort of intimate peculiarities of the subject's life. Someone reading a biography in 2008 would feel positively cheated if they weren't given every last sort of salacious detail,
right,
of what people got up to. And so there's been a deep... it's the whole shift in our sort of dissolution of our sense of privacy and so forth in modern life, I think, which has been enabled by things which are actually very, very beneficial, I think, that, you know, being able to tell the truth about things which before were considered quite unnecessarily to be shameful. And so, I mean, the gay thread is an important one through the book, the story which cannot even be mentioned in the first part of the book, but which is slowly enabled to sort of come to the light.
How did you write it? I mean, how much of a scenario of the entire scenes, the line of it, what was clear to you from the beginning, and how much did you discover as you were writing it?
I never start without having a pretty clear sense of the kind of architecture of the whole book.
And that's the word I was looking for. Very good.
And of certain key episodes that are going to appear in it, and I would find it very worrying just starting writing. I mean, I think there are great novels probably have been written this way by people who just start writing and see what happens. You know. I like to have a pretty clear structure in my mind. But of course there are all sorts of things that I don't know. The book was originally designed to be about 250 pages long, and with five sections of about 50 pages each. When I finished the first section and found that it was just over 100 pages, I knew I was in trouble. But that, the trouble was partly caused by my inevitable thing, I think, when you get into the world of your characters more and more, and sort of you discover more about them, and the thing takes on all kinds of interest which you simply can't anticipate. And to me it would be absolutely deadly if you really knew everything about the book before you started writing it, because so much of the joy of writing lies in the discoveries you make as you go along. So there probably were quite a lot of significant changes to the original plan. There's a sort of, I think there's always with me a play between plan and improvisation, as it were.
Well, and I think it's important too. One aspect of your writing is that you let us see the situation. You don't tell us what's happening. You let us see it happen. I mean, you don't say, "Well, now on this date and this year and this place, this is what happened." No, you're there and it's happening.
Yes. Well, that was very much the effect that I wanted to get. There's no framing narrative or anything, and you're just there with the characters. And I mean, it is very much, I suppose, a book about how people make sense of their lives and the stories they tell to give shape to their lives in retrospect. And so I thought it would be interesting to put the reader on a sort of equal footing with them somehow. I think, you know, there's a great deal of uncertainty and of the unresolved in this book. I think I've got more and more dissatisfied with a certain structural idea, which I used a lot early on, that a book contains some very important secret which, when it's revealed just before the end, makes everything else make sense. And it seems to me that life is not like that. As this book was going to be very much about things which actually could never be known, you know, the reader is privy to certain things definitely happening. But there are all sorts of things that the reader will be as vague about as a lot of the other characters are. So I wanted to sort of make that element of uncertainty part of the whole nature of the book, really.
How much research did you have to do for it?
Very much. I'm never very keen on research, so what I like to have is little details which I find sort of suggestive, and I have to make sure that I can see the scene, the world of the house and everything clearly. I was very keen to get the language right, so I wanted the people in each period not to say things that they wouldn't have said there, and I wanted my narrative for each period to be kind of consistent with the language of that period without actually being sort of pastiche of it, so one wouldn't introduce sort of figures of speech and so on which came from a later
era. I've seen that happen, but I didn't detect anything in here that...
Well, I'm reassured. I mean, I various friends at a late stage pointed out little anachronisms of that kind, which I was very grateful for. But not really. You have to get things right, so of course I checked details. To me it was much more important that the thing sort of grew to richness in my imagination rather than feeling that I was just sort of collating a whole lot of researched facts. You know.
Well, it's just a marvellous work, and I hope it won't be 7 years until the next one.
No, I do hope not.
Are you working on another novel? Or?
Working would be too strong of...
Thinking about
it. Yes, I am thinking about it very, very much. It's very hard to actually work on something when you're still going around involved with the previous book. And I always have quite a gap in between, but I hope to start writing next spring or something.
Well, it's terrific. The Stranger's Child by my guest, Alan Hollinghurst, and it's published by Knopf. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Book Talk is now available. You can receive an MP3 of Book Talk every week free of charge for your MP3 player or home computer. Links to subscribe to all of KALW's local podcasts are at kalw.org. And that's Book Talk for this week. I'm Alan Farley. Thank you for listening.